Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation. Today, it's with Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank about the home mortgage crisis, but also about the crisis in the Republican Party over the arrest of a senator in a public men's room. But first, perhaps responding to critics such as Congressman Frank, who charged President Bush with indifference to the plight of homeowners, President Bush today outlined some steps he wants government to take to help homeowners with risky mortgages keep their homes.
It's not the government's job to bail out speculators or those who made the decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford. Yet there are many American homeowners who could get through this difficult time with a little flexibility from their lenders or a little help from their government.
That help will include allowing more homeowners with spotty credit records to sign up for the Federal Mortgage Insurance Program and encouraging the government-sponsored housing finance companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to help low-income holders of subprime mortgages refinance or renegotiate their loans. Well, Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. He joins us. Richard, 2 weeks ago, the president said many Americans are struggling because they failed to read the fine print on their loans. Now, this announcement of help, what's changed?
Well, the politics has changed. You're seeing presidential candidates speak out on this subject. And, of course, the scale of the challenge in the financial markets has got considerably worse. So there are those two factors going on here. And the president is responding late, but ideologically it's going to be difficult for Republicans at any point because they enter into this moral hazard question of who's to blame in the marketplace.
And who to so-called bail out. Well, you mentioned that the crisis might get worse. In the next 18 months, analysts say the low rates are going to expire on more than 2 million low-interest adjustable-rate mortgages. That's worth a staggering $400 billion, and that's going to create a whole new wave of foreclosures to add to the ones that we already have. And then that problem will be compounded by falling real estate prices so that homeowners and lenders can't even sell off these properties. So it's getting much worse, as you said.
Right, and it's all happening through a presidential election. You know, this kind of situation, frankly, dwarfs the numbers we've been hearing about, whether it's from Senator Hillary Clinton, who's talked about $1 billion for a bailout, or the kind of numbers that the president's been talking about, where he may be talking about 80,000 mm-hmm. extra people covered by this federal insurance scheme. So there is the scale of the problem is really enormous, and it dwarfs the political rhetoric.
Well, the president will have to work with Congress on parts of his plan. As we said, Democrats have been pushing these ideas. We're going to speak with Congressman Barney Frank about how some of his ideas would work, and some of them are the same as the president's. But how is the president going to handle Republicans who, as we said, are going to describe this as a bailout and who also fear that selling more mortgages to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, removes that money from the private sector?
Well, you have to see some context here. Behind the scenes, it's a typical Washington story. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, two very important, powerful institutions, they have also been the subject of intensive lobbying campaigns by a bunch of conservative-leaning groups, and especially by banks and mortgage companies who feel that they have grown too powerful. They're private sector companies, but with a federal government backing behind them. So there's been an intense lobbying war about them, and really right now they could play a crucial role in stepping in and stabilizing these markets. The administration has so far refused to really expand their role, and there is, as I said, a lobbying factor right there. But this goes much broader than, I think, the normal ideological lines, because in the end, the number of people involved, the sheer political pressure of people losing their homes will trump everything. I mean, something has to be done to help people out of what is a very personal and stressful situation.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Richard, thanks as always.
Anytime.
Well, as we've been saying, the Bush administration has been resistant to making changes in the home mortgage market till today. Just yesterday afternoon, we reached Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, head of the House Financial Services Committee.
The Treasury Department of the U.S. and the Federal Reserve were unpleasantly surprised by the extent to which this became more than just a shakeout in the mortgage market. And it's carried over to the broader credit market, and that's why, frankly, we're going to be having a big hearing next week. Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, so surprised, and does that mean we need to change the rules so they get better information earlier?
Well, we ended up having an extended conversation with Barney Frank that also included his thoughts on the scandal surrounding Idaho Senator Larry Craig. We'll have that part of the conversation in a moment. But first, next week's hearings will include relief for homeowners and regulation for lenders. We asked Frank to explain, so get ready for a financial primer. We'll start with the relief.
There are some people who unfortunately, are probably beyond help. As you correctly say, look, there are some people who, frankly, shouldn't have bought homes. But there are some people who could continue to make the mortgage payments they've been making if their interest rates don't jump up. As you said, there were these people who got the teaser loans, and often they were called 228s and 327s. You got the low rate for 2 years or 3 years, and then for the rest of the 30 years it jumped up. Now, many of these people could refinance. They are able to pay at the existing rate. The problem is that in order to sell their mortgages as securities into what is called the secondary market, they had to include prepayment penalties. So many of these people who could afford to keep paying the mortgage that they're now paying but can't pay the higher rate are unable to refinance because they would have to make a prepayment penalty.
Right, because when you once you refinance, you literally sell your loan to someone else and maybe you adjust it so that in this case you would not have those rising interest rates. But in the small print, it says you can't do that.
You can't do that without paying more than you've got. So one of the things we've been working on is to say to the people who hold the mortgages, the financial people, you know what? You could theoretically insist on every letter of the contract, and the result will be a lot of foreclosures, and you'll wind up owning a lot of vacant property in Cleveland. And we don't think that's in your interest economically, partly because, as you mentioned, we have a problem of declining property values. The more there is foreclosure, the more property values in general will go down. So what we have said to the people who own the mortgages, to whom the payments are due, why don't you be reasonable and let people out of the prepayment penalty? You won't get as much as you plan to get, but you'll get more than you would get if you foreclosed. Now, we were able to get the bank regulators, the FDIC and the Comptroller of the Currency, to tell the banks to do that. But here's the problem. If only banks regulated by the federal government and state governments had made these loans, we wouldn't have this problem. This is a classic case of excessive deregulation because the overwhelming number of loans that are going to fail if we don't do something were made not by regulated banks but by unregulated lenders. And they, in turn, sold them as securities, as you just explained, into what's called the secondary market. So we have been able to persuade some of the banks to say, look, be reasonable. Don't foreclose. Don't have a prepayment penalty. Let the people refinance. But these mortgages that are held by anonymous holders of securities, it's harder to do that. What we did do, and it's technical, but it's actually kind of important, there's an institution called the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB. It's the board that sets accounting standards. They have a standard that governs what your responsibility is. If you're the person who packaged up these mortgages, sold them as a security, and you service them, that is, you collect the money from the people who took out the loans, and you remit them to the owners. What we got the standard board to say was, you know what, if you can realize that it's not in the interest of the people to whom you sold these securities to foreclose and have a lot of vacant property that's going to deteriorate, and instead it's better to get some money, you can also get rid of the prepayment penalty. So we are working hard on that. Then the second thing we're doing, saying to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two big federally chartered housing finance entities, we would like you to be available to buy the mortgages that have been refinanced, even though they might be a little risky. But you get a lot of advantages from your association with the federal government. Mortgages, when you get a mortgage, one of two things can happen to it. It can be held by the institution that lent you the money or another institution in its portfolio, which is the phrase, or it can be sold to as a security. Now, the people who believe that the free market is the answer to everything have said, oh, let's not hold any things in the portfolio. Let's sell them into the secondary market. The problem there is, frankly, if I make a mortgage loan to you, and I'm going to hold on, and I'm going to be the one who collects your payments, I'm going to be worried about your ability to make the payment. But if I make the loan and then I immediately sell it to somebody else, I'm much less concerned about that. That's one of the reasons we got these irresponsible loans. So what we're saying is, you know, in the current situation, don't just sell them off. We want Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to be able to hold on to them in their portfolio. The other thing is people have said, well, but Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will be taking risks. Here's our proposal on this. The law currently says Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac cannot buy mortgages that are above $417,000. We want to lift that limit. People are now having trouble getting these mortgages because people say, well, in this chancy market, we don't want to give you a mortgage if we can't sell it to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. We want to increase that limit. If we do that, they will make more money because those are profitable things. We're willing to say to them, you know what, we'll help you make some more money at the high end if you will agree to recycle some of that and take more risks at the low end.
Well, Barney Frank, just real quickly, you talked about regulating the unregulated lenders. How would you do that?
Frankly, Robin, it's an easy job because banks have been regulated. What we have to do is simply take the regulations that have already been applied by these federal and state regulators to the regulated entities, the banks, and apply them to the unregulated mortgage brokers. We will say that if you're a mortgage broker, you now better follow the rules that, for instance, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, imposed on banks. Secondly, we want to say to the people who are in the business of packaging these up and selling them as securities, do not sell into the secondary market, as it's called, into the securities market, a loan that never should have been made in the first place.
In other words, somebody's credit has to be higher before...
It's a fairly simple thing, and it may sound odd, but don't lend people money if there's no reasonable chance they can pay it back.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, if people know what bank examiners are. Bank examiners go regularly into the banks, and they look at their books, and they say, well, you were lending imprudently. You lent this person too much money. They may also say, look, you didn't do enough in these neighborhoods because we do have some social obligations. The essential principle is don't lend people more money than they can pay back. Don't get people hooked by saying, you know what, the interest rate will be so low, your payments will only be $900 a month for the first 2 years without telling them that they're going to go up to $1,700 or $1,800 a month in the third year.
Yeah. And how do you determine who qualifies for this relief? Just about every American would say, I'm having a tough time making my mortgage.
Right. That's why we are not talking about letting people off the hook totally. Then everybody else would say, well, why should I pay my mortgage? So
right.
I have differed with some of my friends who want to declare a moratorium on all mortgage foreclosures or have the federal government pay them out. What we're saying is, let people out of the prepayment penalty so they can refinance. That's a very limited category of people. Those are the people who took the mortgages that had a low teaser rate and are going to jump up forward.
Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, and also openly gay, with some strong opinions on the controversy surrounding Idaho Senator Larry Craig. So what we're going to do is we're really going to change topics, and when we come back, we'll speak with Barney Frank on that issue. And later in the program, the new embassy in Iraq, the new American embassy, $500 million to build, $1 billion a year to maintain, and it looks like a box store. Is this the new face of American diplomacy around the world? We'll speak with an architect. But back with Barney Frank, here and now, in just 1 minute. Young, it's here and now. We're back with more from Democratic Congressman Barney Frank. We spoke with him about mortgages, but Frank is also openly gay, and we wanted his opinion on the Larry Craig scandal. Craig, a Republican senator from Idaho, was arrested in a men's room in the Minneapolis airport in June. He pled guilty to disorderly conduct when charges related to soliciting an undercover cop, but has since said he's not gay. And yesterday, a portion of the police tape of that arrest was released.
I am not gay. I don't do these kind of things, and that doesn't matter. I don't care about sexual preference or anything like that. I don't care about sexual preference. I know you don't. But you're out to enforce the law,
right?
But you shouldn't be out to entrap people either. This is an entrapment, all right?
Well, Republicans have been calling for Craig to step down. In fact, Idaho's governor has now reportedly decided that his lieutenant governor, Jim Risch, would be Craig's replacement if Craig does resign. But Democrat Barney Frank says he shouldn't resign. We asked why.
Well, I condemn his hypocrisy, and I think the hypocrisy is a valid reason for people not to vote for him. I think that when you set yourself up to make rules for people and then don't follow them yourself, you're committing a very grave error, and that's a reason not to vote for you. But when you've been elected, it seems to me you serve out the term unless you have been shown to be misusing your office. Look, we have a senator from Louisiana, Senator Vitter, who has acknowledged that he was patronizing this prostitution. People haven't asked for him to resign. Now, I don't think people should be soliciting sex in public bathrooms, and I certainly don't think people should be hypocrites. But we're not talking now about someone who's shot someone or bodily injured someone. And the fact is that comparable infractions among heterosexuals haven't led to demands to resign. So now he is also, by the way, in his next to last year of his term. He's up for re-election next year. It's obvious to me that he won't be re-elected. He will probably not run again. If he does, he'd lose in a Republican primary. I think that's appropriate. I think this is the kind of poor judgment and inappropriate behavior that ought to count against you when you're running. But it is, if you look at people who've done similar things, they have generally not been asked to resign.
Well, let's do that, because as you well know, Republicans, you well know that your name is being invoked in this debate. Republicans are saying that Democrats are being hypocritical. And Tom DeLay was on the Today Show saying that Republicans are, first of all, unfairly singled out, that Republicans, at least as he said, jettison their scandals. You know, Republicans are pushing for Larry Craig to step down while Democrats reelect them. And he mentioned your story. In 1985, you had a relationship with a male escort before you came out.
I was not charged with any crime. It was not in any public place. The crime, by the way, I hope the crime that people are talking about with Larry Craig is not being sexually attracted to a man, but to have done this in a public bathroom in a way that was disruptive. People have a right to walk into a bathroom and not be confronted with other people's sexual activities. That's the crime. And no, I never did anything like that. I never was guilty of anything that involved anything in the public. Secondly, this notion that the Republicans deal with the scandals, what about Senator Vitter?
Who admitted to being a part of a prostitution ring.
And what about Senator Stevens of Alaska? The FBI just raided his house, and they haven't resigned.
Well, a conservative talk show host, Joe Scarborough, who a former Republican lawmaker, says, very critical of his party, he says Republicans are suffering now with stories like Larry Craig's, if in fact it's true, because they're forcing their colleagues to stay in the closet in order to hold on to the conservative Christian base. Do you have some concerns about that or thinking about that?
Let me just say, finally, that, and I will get to that, but in terms of scandals, there are far more serious scandals than Larry Craig's. I think taking money to do bad public policy things, like Duke Cunningham did, who's now in prison, or Bob Ney, whom I admired in some ways, but who clearly violated the law, these people who were engaged in corrupt schemes with Jack Abramoff to degrade public policy.
Or William Jefferson, a Democrat.
Yes, who's under indictment, and I voted to support Nancy Pelosi when she forced him off the Ways and Means Committee over his objection, and I refused to join in the criticism of the FBI for raiding his office. Those are far more serious than what Larry Craig did. Sex, I guess, titillates. So, you know, some of the cases I'm talking about, most people wouldn't even have heard of. Now, as far as the closet case, yes, but it's not just Republican politicians. When people are going to be suffering some discrimination because of some aspect of their personality, it does have some say in the closet. And yeah, I'm an example of that because it is true. When I was closeted and was hiding from people the true nature of who I was, I found it very difficult to have social relationships, so I behaved inappropriately. Once I decided to go public with who I was, when those of us who are gay discuss our sexuality, it's a big deal. It's called coming out. Of course, heterosexuals frequently discuss their sexuality, except it's called talking. But this is one of the prices you pay in the closet. Now, there is one difference between the parties. Those of us who are gay or lesbian on the Democratic side, who have been engaged in politics and who have decided to be honest about who we are, have generally been supported by our party and prospered. On the other side, Republicans who are gay, very few lesbians, who do acknowledge this, generally get forced out of office by their own party.
It's part of the reason you said that you don't feel he should leave office for all the reasons you listed, but is part of that answer you don't want to be in the position of saying a man should resign because he's gay or may be gay.
I'm saying there shouldn't be this differential treatment.
Yeah.
Yes, and I do think that I think the fact that he's gay has exacerbated the reaction. Now, what he did was wrong, and of course, in the nature of the case, I guess it would be very hard to have an exact analogy because making an advance for sexual purposes in a heterosexual way in a bathroom, for obvious reasons, doesn't happen. But by the way, I don't think David Vitter should resign. And I do make this distinction. I don't think people who do other things that are inappropriate, that may be minor violations. We're talking about a misdemeanor here, but he didn't. He got a small fine and unsupervised probation. I don't think those ought to short-circuit the electoral process. I do think those are reasonable things for people to take into account when you run for re-election. I mean, with Bill Clinton, I didn't think Bill Clinton should be thrown out of office, but it did seem to me, and I said at the time, that if that was in his first term, it would have been a real obstacle to his getting re-elected, and appropriately so.
Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, speaking to us about the mortgage crisis and much more. Congressman, thank you, as always.
You're welcome.
Well, something tells me you might have some thoughts out there. If you'd like to send them, we'd love to hear them. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org. You can always call, leave a message, 617-358-0397. We'd love to hear from you. Still ahead, a sneak preview of the new U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. It's huge, but will it open here and now? It's here and now. While lawmakers debate withdrawing from Iraq, Baghdad's massive new American embassy is scheduled to open tomorrow. It sits on 104 acres. That's six times the size of the United Nations complex in New York. And the new embassy in Iraq will be the world's largest. It cost $500 million to build. It'll cost $1 billion a year to run. It has its own electricity plant, housing and water, sewer and maintenance systems, all surrounded by high blast walls. Designers point to these features with pride. But to our next guest, the new Baghdad embassy looks more like a crusader castle than a cause for celebration. Joining us here in the studio, Jane Loeffler, who teaches architectural history at the University of Maryland and wrote the book, The Architecture of Diplomacy, Building America's Embassies. She writes about the new embassy for the current edition of Foreign Policy magazine. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, we should say we talked to the State Department and they said the target date was September 1st. Not likely that it's going to actually open tomorrow. What have you heard?
I've heard the same thing. It's not likely to open tomorrow. I don't think it's finished. Then you have to define finished. Maybe people will be able to move into parts of it sometime soon. Maybe it will take longer than that. But it is not complete.
Well, where exactly is it?
It's inside the green zone. It's a heavily fortified area to begin with, and then fortified more within that area. It's a, as you mentioned, it's a tremendous compound.
Well, now, we should say you haven't been to it or seen it, but
no.
You saw it online, or the plans online, as many people did. Tell us about that.
Well, there was a sighting of plans posted on the website of the architects who are in charge of the overall project earlier this year, and the website was quickly eliminated from the internet by the, they pulled it off, but many people had pulled off the drawings by then. And they're not photographs, and they're not drawings of actual buildings. I need to point out that this is a virtual exploration, we'll call it, that we've done in Foreign Policy, and these are artist renderings of what they probably will look like or close to what they look like. So it's more of a generic exploration of what the type of the buildings. They look somewhat like big box stores.
They
like
do.
Warehouses.
They do. Well, first of all, let's just describe some other features as you and others have researched them. You say Americans won't ever have to leave the grounds. What else is supposed to be in the embassy?
Well, it's going to have its own shopping, its own recreation, its own, as you said, power and water supply and sewage supply and clubs and so forth.
Movie theaters,
entertainment, whatever. So they won't have to leave the place, and that's good and it's bad. It's good because it protects them, and it's bad because it cuts us off from the community in which we're posted. And beyond that, it doesn't say something great about our willingness to, our optimism for that community.
Tell us a little more about that, that as it's called the architecture of diplomacy. I mean, there was a time when embassies were meant to send a signal of openness, of inclusion. Tell us more about how embassies enabled diplomats to interact with the communities.
Back in from the whole history of U.S. representation abroad, we've tended to pick very prominent sites and cities in capital cities so that we would have our embassies at a very good location in terms of visibility and accessibility. And so it could play a role in the community culturally and politically, economically, so businesses could access it. And this is not true now. For security reasons, they've been moved to the outskirts of cities. In particular, since 1983 bombings in Beirut, they have been basically moving towards 15-acre sites or more on the outskirts of the city so they can be, you know, enough land is available there for purchase and it can be properly enclosed.
Which is why these tend to look more like bases or, mm-hmm. as you write, citadels than, mm-hmm. You know, sort of goodwill ambassadors. But isn't that, I mean, is there any other way?
No, it makes no sense to build a glass box in the middle of Baghdad or any other capital, not a war zone, but any other capital today. So we couldn't do that anymore. But we can build safe buildings as secure as we're building and make them attractive as well. We can still try and send a signal of positive statement about the United States. That is an opportunity that is being lost.
You're someone who studied architectural history. You've already said that the new embassy in Baghdad looks like a box store, and it's part of something called standard embassy design. What's that?
Standard design is a process that the State Department is using all over the world to build new embassies that are going to look essentially like Best Buy stores. Not exactly, and they won't have that sign in front, but they have that similarity, and you'll see, if you see them at all behind the walls, you'll see something that looks very much the same, whether you're in Africa or Asia or South America. The new standard embassy design makes sense in a third world setting, perhaps, where you have nothing there, and you're building for the first time an embassy in Dushanbe or Lome or someplace like that. But it's not sending the same signal if we sell our embassy in London, which is being talked about, and move out of London, for example, and sell in Oslo. But we have a very long history of association of the U.S. government's presence in Grosvenor Square in London, and it will be a very sad comment on our role in the world if we have to abandon that location and get out of town.
You say there's talk of that. What signal would that send? Why does that matter?
Architecture really matters. Architecture says a lot about us. It tells us about what we hope, our individuality, our talent, our creativity as a culture. The Capitol in Washington, if it looked like a box, I don't think you'd feel the same way about it if you came to see the Capitol and you walked in and you were in a shopping mall type of situation, or if you it looked like a warehouse.
And this is how other countries will see the U.S.?
Possibly. This is our face to the world.
So there's a bunker. It almost feels like a bunker mentality. You're nodding your head yes.
Yeah, it is. That's one of the fears, that's one of the concerns that Foreign Service officers have expressed, is that they really can't do their job when they're cut off like that, and they don't want to be cut off.
Do you see some irony that this embassy is being, you know, the finishing touches are being put on it just as there's a good chance that U.S. troops and participation in Iraq might be ending. You know, there might be a pullout leaving this $500 million edifice.
It would be terrible. Remember, this was conceived right after we, you know, arrived in Baghdad, and they made the probably terrible decision to establish U.S. embassy in Saddam Hussein's palace, which was, you know, symbolically not a great move. But the this whole project started out when things looked different. The bad side of that is if you have to leave it, you're leaving something tremendous behind. But I hope they don't have to leave it.
Jane Loeffler teaches architectural history at the University of Maryland and is author of the book The Architecture of Diplomacy, Building America's Embassies. Jane, thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go today, a rare visit with 93-year-old Frederick Franklin, the man who brought ballet to America. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, many of us can look forward to relaxing over Labor Day weekend, but no, no holiday in the world of sports. We've got the U.S. Open, women's pro basketball semifinals, college football kicks off, and there's bound to be a wiffle ball game on a beach near you. So let's turn to Bill Littlefield. He's host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, as always, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Before we get to the U.S. Open, it's that time of year again. We do this every year. Okay, I know it's Wimbledon, Wimbledon, Wimbledon. When is it going to take for me to know how to say that?
But Bud Collins corrects us so politely whenever we do it, so it's all right.
Well, I say it with a T, and so it bothers so many of you, so I'm sorry. I'm going to start working now for next year.
Okay.
Okay, back to Flushing Meadows with an S, where the U.S. Open in its sixth day of matches highlights so far.
Well, James Blake won a five-set match, and five-set matches are by definition dramatic, mm-hmm. so that was great. And he's a sweetheart. He's a great guy, so it was good to see him win. And, of course, we're getting to the point where all of those very talented and accomplished women who are crowded into the same half of the draw
right.
will soon have to start playing each other, so right. that'll be exciting.
Right. Women's pro basketball, speaking of women, we're into the conference finals now. The games have been pretty close. Of the 11 first-round games, five were decided by 5 points or fewer. Four teams now remain, defending WNBA champs Detroit up against Indiana in the East, in the West, Phoenix and San Antonio. Your predictions?
Well, Phoenix won by 2 points last night after a disputed foul, just like the NBA.
Whoa.
The refs don't know what they're doing, and there were 2 seconds left when they won on two foul shots, so they've got two games to win one against San Antonio. They'll probably win that series. Those games are both at home for Phoenix. I would imagine Detroit would probably win on the other side. They're the defending champs, and I think a Detroit-Phoenix series would be a great final.
And wouldn't it be great if people watched? I mean, are they watching? Are they picking up?
Well, I'm not sure what the television ratings are. I haven't really looked at that. But if you look at the games, and this was true even at the end of the regular season before the playoffs began, no matter what the camera angle was, there were lots and lots of people in the stands. And so mm-hmm. I think the attendance is probably very strong. I'm not sure, as I say, about the
right,
TV ratings.
Right. Well, the NFL season kicks off on Thursday. College teams have already started on the road to New Orleans, where the national championship game will be played in January. Last night, number 2, Louisiana State University, crushed Mississippi State. Last year's surprise team, Rutgers, ranked 16 right now, beat Buffalo 38-3. Do you think it's going to get a little more exciting than that?
I always wonder in a game like that if the team that's ahead by 38 points leaves the field in order to let the other team kick a field goal.
Something
that won't make it quite so bad. Yeah, highly regarded teams very rarely play other highly regarded teams early in the season. It's known as padding your schedule, and it's good for the unregarded teams, too, because they get a paycheck.
Okay, on to soccer, the other football. David Beckham, LA Galaxy, his ankle was gimpy, we saw, and then this week he sprains his knee. Word is he's going to miss the whole season. This has got to be disappointing for the whole league.
Well, as you say, his ankle was gimpy. We didn't see, because when he was in New England, he didn't play in that game against the Revolution. He did play brilliantly after that, scored a patented David Beckham goal very shortly after that, went home and played for England again very well a whole game. Unfortunately, yes, a second injury. And Alexi Lalas, who started off his career, of course, here with the New England Revolution, old friend Alexi Lalas, now the general manager of the Galaxy, must be having an awful time.
Yeah, as are fans across the country, you know, who really want to
see
him.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I just want to mention one thing. I've got some friends here, the fabulous Bill and Owen Ritter from New York, who are doing a five-city, five-baseball-teams five games tour. Now, apparently this is a real trend. And I just have to say they're New Yorkers, so I'm kind of glad that they're here in Boston and going to Fenway Park tonight. But they missed the New York-Boston series.
Exactly.
In New York.
If they're New Yorkers, they should have done the one city, three games tour. They would have seen the Yankees beat the Red Sox 3 days in a row. But more power to them. And I'm glad that the price of gas has dropped slightly.
Well, in fact, you have another recommendation for people along these lines.
I think it's fun to do that some number of cities in some number of days baseball tour with minor league teams.
Yeah.
Often the parking is free, the tickets and the food are cheaper, and you're seeing the stars of tomorrow. It's kind of fun.
Right, and you might avoid the Red Sox demise. Anyway, Bill Littlefield covers sports and so much more on NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And just after a minute break, classic stories from classical ballet icon Frederick Franklin at 93, just a minute away, here and now.
Oh.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 93-year-old ballet legend Frederick Franklin returns to center stage this year with a new book, Frederick Franklin, A Biography of the Ballet Star. Not that Franklin has ever moved that far from center stage. He's an enduring light in the world of dance. Born in Liverpool, England, he wowed audiences worldwide in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s when he danced with the fabled Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo.
I would be so honored to get your autograph. Would you mind?
Last summer, Frederick Franklin made a personal appearance at the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts, greeting generations of admirers, including a charter member of his fan club.
I was number one in 1941.
He was promoting a documentary about the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, which helped establish ballet in this country by barnstorming across the U.S. in trains and buses, starting in the early days of World War II, when ballet was new to Americans.
We were in the covered wagons of the ballet in this country. We were. We would go to towns, many towns. They'd just look, open-mouthed audiences, not never seen anything like us. Strange people with strange names and strange looking, wearing strange costumes, doing strange things. No way, no.
Here and Now's Lynn Manigan found Frederick Franklin regaling his fans with stories about some of the old ballet greats.
In a crowded room before the screening of his film, Freddie, as he's known, dressed in a summer suit jacket and sneakers, remembered the time Margot Fonteyn had just performed a matinee.
We were doing Sleeping Beauty, and she was 54, 55 at this time. And she was, some friends had come, she was getting ready to go out and have a lovely dinner and lovely glass of wine. And our manager, Mr. Ralph Black, knocked on the door and said, Margot, he said, is there anything I can bring you? Oh, she said, no, no, I'm going out. He said, oh, no, darling, you're on again tonight. She said, what? She said, showed her the contract. And I don't know how she signed to go on twice. Sleeping Beauty's enough for one person in a month.
And she did it?
She did it, and the second performance was brilliant. Better than the matinee.
Difficult circumstances, but Franklin also described some difficult people, like the stern Russian choreographer, Madame Bronislava Nijinska.
So she came, and she looked around, and she had a husband that translated all that she said. And I do believe that some of the things he wouldn't translate, that was so awful. Anyway, and she was going to redo the last act of The Nutcracker. So this is exactly what happened. We started. And then we stopped, and we started. And it went on for 3/4 of an hour. Now, it's a big, jumping, crazy dance. Well, by that time, I had worn out 2 pairs of shoes. Then we had a Russian pianist by the name of Madame Fox. She goes to Madame Fox and says something, and Madame Fox says, Freddie, do you know what Madame Dzinska just said? And I said, no. She said, now she make you real Russian boy. You are good Russian dancer now. That was my beginning.
It used to be said, my generation, when Freddie Franklin came into the room, the sun came out.
Ballet scholar Anne Hutchinson Guest once danced with Franklin.
He just had such expansiveness, such enthusiasm, such openness. He was always so positive, as you can see.
Her husband Ivor, also a dance critic, said Franklin had a terrific presence on stage.
I mean, he had everything. He had good masculine looks and the masculine allure, which one didn't see very often, actually. They didn't have the star quality that he had.
What makes a star?
Well, only God knows.
Well, that might explain the source of Frederick Franklin's energy. As the Ballet Russe movie screened behind us, he had a few minutes to reminisce.
You never stop, do you?
It's been since I got here. No, I had 10 minutes.
And
I've been going ever since.
Is that something you learned on all those Ballet Russe trains across America?
You know, I suppose when you really think about getting on the train 8 in the morning and then getting off 6, going to the theatre, do the show, the curtain would come down, and then we'd rehearse until the train left, go down 2:30 and get on the train and go to the next one. That's how it used to be. It was quite something. Then I must tell you about one time, we're in Arizona,
like Phoenix or Tucson. Wait, you know, Phoenix and Tucson had once dirt road. That's all it was. We meet 9 o'clock in the morning outside the hotel. There was a horse, there was a cart, and there was on the side, Ballyrus, it said. We got in, take this, a gun. Brent, take this, a gun. The driver will drive you around, and I want you to keep shooting off the guns. I'd never had a gun in my hand. We fired off the just to get the attention to what was happening that night. But that was it. That was what it was all about. I guess you see, that's why I'm still here doing it.
I was going to ask, how do you stay so young? You just turned 92.
Yes.
And I am astonished, and everybody here is astonished at your vitality, your sense of humor.
Well,
your...
you know, I tell you, I believe, and it's, I was born with it. And another thing is, I've always loved what I've done. And I've had a talent, and I've stretched it and used it and done everything I can with it. And it's sort of, it's an awful thing to say, but I'm very grateful for whoever gave it to me, because that's what it's all about.
And in the twilight of his career, Frederick Franklin is still performing. He's not jumping like he used to, but this summer he appeared in acting roles with the American Ballet Theatre.
David Richardson, who was then the co-artistic director, said to me one day, he said, "Now, Fred, you'll be on as the friar in Romeo and Juliet on Friday." I said, "Just a moment." I said, "What about the choreography?" Oh, he said, "Now, come here." He got a piece of paper and he wrote, "Now, you enter, you go to the right and you kneel. Then you get up and then he comes on and lifts you up. And then she comes on and then you bless them and you go off. And then there's the next. You come on and you have the vial and you go out, you hear a noise, you come on and she comes and you, oh, poor dear, give her the vial. She does that and goes off. That is the rehearsal." Well, I must say, but I'll never forget, I was standing waiting to go on, and you know, I'm not that sure of the music. Here you go, and they opened the curtains. Well, there were some very nice people who'd remembered me, and they applauded. The ballet flew out of my head. I knelt, and I thought, somebody will pick me up. And I've been picked up all the time.
Dancer Frederick Franklin entertaining fans at the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts last summer. Leslie Norton's book, Frederick Franklin, A Biography of the Ballet Star, came out this summer. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our piece on Frederick Franklin was produced by Lynn Menegon. The rest of the production team, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Metzen, Margaret Evans, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our managing editor, Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great, safe weekend. We'll all be laboring for you here on Monday, so join us then. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.